Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take up consumer scams on the program today. We got a couple of regular guests for you. But, you know, last year, according to the Federal Trade Commission, Americans reported losing $2.1 billion in scams. And that amount is eight times higher than it was in 2020. So a big increase for various reasons. We'll probably find out why as we talk with our two guests today, who do a great job telling you and I how to avoid and identify scams so we don't get scammed. Michelle Reinen, one of our guests from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Michelle's the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michelle, great to see you again.
Well, always great to be here, Larry.
And always great to see Michael Domke as well, who is director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Michael, good to see you.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks, Larry.
As we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or maybe an experience that you want to share relating to this, number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I was thinking about that $2 billion, and you wonder how many of those scammers actually get caught. And we have no idea, probably.
We don't have any idea because some of them are national, others are international. We work together as teams within the states, and then with the national representatives, we work hard to catch those that are within the U.S., and then the federal government works with the internationally to try and catch others. But I just want to make a point about that $2.1 billion. That's just on social media scams. That's not even the total losses across the board. That's 30% of the consumers who lost money to scams reported it, and it started on social media. And that's just that chunk of money. So it's even larger than that. And we've seen that significant increase since 2020 with social media.
That's why it's the big increase in social media.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've always talked the platform of the phone being a big issue. Email is a huge entry point for scammers and identity theft. But the fact that people are now losing so much money just through the platform of social media, we know that scammers are just trying to get at them in that way. But to your point of getting caught, it's really important to report because we can compile all the data and information together and work with those partners. But if it's not reported, we don't know what's happening, and then there's nothing to chase.
Yeah. Well, we have lots to talk about. There's juicing scams. There are juice scams. There's recovery scams. There's barcode scams. David O'Claire has a potential scam to talk about as well, so let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Lately, probably a dozen times this week, I've gotten calls, and I usually ignore them, but a few I've answered. They tell me that my Medicare form is checked no, and it's like I don't stick around long enough to find out what it's all about, but it's definitely a robocall, because when you say hello, there's nothing there, and then they give you a name, and if you say hello to their name, they don't respond, so I usually just hang up on it. But is there something going on now where there's an increase, you know, where they're targeting older adults with some kind of Medicare scam going on?
Yeah. Michael?
Well, unfortunately, we're seeing Medicare scams year-round, but there are ebbs and flows of when we see it rise and fall a little bit. But they are a constant throughout the year, and that is because there's so many different variations of how the Medicare scam is out there and being perpetrated. And one example is what Dave said, and that was kind of a general entry point where they're getting that robocall, waiting for you to respond, see if there's a real person there. And then if you do, you know, he was talking about the box being checked. You know, that's one opportunity for them to get you to engage about your actual participation in the program. And then they use that as a stepping stone to, now let's ask a little bit more information about you. And what we always want to encourage everyone to recognize is that the Medicare ID number is just as valuable as your Social Security number. That can be exploited and used in so many other ways, in so many other scams. And it's not just signing you up for additional programs, but it's signing you up for additional, say, equipment that you don't even realize Because if you're not paying attention to that Medicare, you know, bill, or not bill, but your statement of what's being charged, and you maybe have never used any equipment through it, and so you don't pay any mind to saying, okay, I'm not going to look at this. Why would I? I haven't used any of the benefits in the last few months. And annoyingly, a scammer through a call like this where you're saying, hey, you've checked a box, you verify a few things, and now they have enough information to try and exploit that. It's also getting those calls and saying, all right, you know, in potentially Dave's scenario where he did a great thing and just hung up. But if we do see individuals who engage, it's telling them that, hey, you know what, maybe the checking the box approach didn't work. We'll try a different one, and we'll start talking to them that way. And so it's good to make sure that you're recognizing, hey, let's not engage, and being very cautious not to give out any of the information should you be a participant.
Yeah, good, makes good sense. Dave, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Benjamin in La Crosse is here, so let's go there. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi. Yeah, so a few months ago, I had a speeding ticket, and then I got this text claiming to be the DMV. And so it took me to this website that actually had a .gov, it's a Department of Transportation .gov website. So I actually stupidly, without looking it up, I gave them my credit card information or my debit card information. And the funny thing is every time I'd put in a debit card, it would actually tell me that that debit card doesn't work for them. So then it took me that to finally look it up and find out that, no, you will never get a text from the DMV. So this was with my Chime. I used Chime as my banking. I put in a dispute about 2 months ago, and I still haven't gotten the money back. I was scammed out of, they bought a bunch of stuff on eBay for $400. I'm wondering if this is something I should maybe file a police report for, or...
Or file with DACAP, with Consumer Protection, Michelle?
Yeah, definitely file that complaint with Consumer Protection. We can then check with the credit card company. So in... Just to be transparent with everyone, some credit card companies, when you are actually taking the action and affirming it, that they are not doing complete refunds with all disputes anymore. We've seen a little bit of a trend going that way. We know of some consumers who had given to what they thought was a charity in person and authorized $40, but the scammer, it was a scam charity, did $400 instead. And because it was an authorized transaction and the consumer didn't really see what happened, they didn't allow for the dispute to go through. And so this being an affirmative, you entering the information through the website and it not being manipulated. But it sounds like the eBay aspect of it, you weren't authorizing. It's just handing over the information. So definitely file the complaint. And for everyone else out there, yes, these text messages, really pay attention to them. These scammers are trying to get you to think that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation is letting you know about parking tickets, traffic violations, toll money that you owe. And we've been hit again this spring, just like we were last spring, very heavily with these scams. And that is not how collections are made and payments are made. We don't have tolls here. And when you have a speeding ticket or traffic violation, it doesn't come from the state DMV. It comes from the authority that issued that ticket to you. So if it's a state patrol, maybe. But if it's the county or the city or the other municipality, it's going to come from them.
From them.
So really be paying attention if you do get one of those violations.
We should give the phone number to call and the email address.
Yeah, absolutely. So the phone number to call the Consumer Protection Hotline is 1-800-422-7128. And our website, to be able to just file a complaint online or get a fact sheet, is datcp.wi.gov.
If I could add something, Larry, to that.
Sure.
Something that Benjamin said about, you know, going on to the website and entering the information, and he said, you know, he stupidly did this, which, you know, I just want to emphasize that for years we've talked about, you know, looking at that web address, and which he did. and looking at that website, and what I want to point out is you really can't look at just one thing anymore. You really have to do a little bit more research, because the website, we've seen the website for some of these links that you take it to, it's identical to with the real Wisconsin DOT. The web address is very similar to the real one. And so we really can't pick out those one or two things that are going to be the red flag. You got to kind of look for two or three now. And, you know, as Benjamin pointed out, he wasn't stupid. It was just that this was a very convincing scam. It was, and that's why we're saying now you got to do a little bit more deeper digging, because they're getting harder and harder to determine what's real and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much for that call. I appreciate it. Rod in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry.
Hey, Rod.
Hi, Larry. Let me congratulate you on your retirement.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm calling to give you an odd comment on the scamming. My mom, who lives in Montello, lives alone, and she's 99 years old, and she doesn't want us to do anything to stop the scamming phone calls because they keep her company all day long. And she likes it.
But yeah.
I've heard of that before. That's one of the things the scammers count on, is actually being able to engage with individuals who might be isolated or not have regular company and an outlet to converse with.
Yeah. So what is she? Is she spending her money?
No. That's one of the benefits of her age and her infirmities. Is she doesn't have any access to her money or can't use any credit cards over the phone, so they've got no ability to get any money from her, but they definitely do spend a lot of time with her on the phone.
Wow. Now that one I haven't heard.
Yeah, the only thing I'd be cautious of there is while they can't get money, they could still get her information. You know, they could still get information about her or family or others in order for that scammer to pivot.
Social security number.
Mm-hmm. And if she had, you know, a social security number, but if she had other banking numbers in front of her or just dates of birth of family members and things through that conversation, would be the true caution there of continuing those conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we see a lot of scammers that are what's called social engineering, and so they have these conversations where they're going to use that as an opportunity to learn more about her family, and then use that as kind of a stepping stone to, all right, now we're going to call this family member, using what they learned through those conversations with his mom. So I totally agree. You know, I fully understand how the emotional satisfaction of having the conversations and the interaction is there. Just be cautious that it's not just the information she might provide about herself, but how it might be used for the family as well.
Yeah, good points. Rod, thanks very much for calling and sharing that. Appreciate it very much. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, our guests today from the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. It's always great to have them come by. What's going on in your life relating to this? Some experiences to share or questions to ask? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk consumer protection and scams with our two guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke. Michelle's administrator of DATCAP's division of Trade and Consumer Protection, Michael, the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. They've been doing this a long time and know a lot, obviously. And if you have a question or maybe an experience to share, hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I saw the title of juice jacking, and I wondered what the heck it was about. It wasn't about the juice that you might have for breakfast.
No, it is not. Deceptive title. What it's really about is using public charging kiosks when you're most likely at an airport or a public location where, and these are the ones where it has the cord installed in the side and you can go ahead and leave your phone, whether it be in a locker or right there sitting out as you stand next to it. And what we want to make bring kind of awareness to is that there's a small device that criminals are using that kind of tampers with it. And what it does is it kind of steals the information through that data cord, because the charging cord is also a data cord. And what it does then is when you plug it in, it's then at that point kind of importing all the information and data from your phone when you think you're really just charging it. So what we want everyone to be understanding is when that happens, you might see little things that would tell you that, hey, there's an indicator that something went sideways, such as malware or the phone getting locked out. And then you're getting a call or a text that says, here's what you're going to have to do to unlock your phone or get the information back. Or this is going to compromise some of the passwords. You know, a lot of our phones comes with software, or you download an app that keeps your passwords for you. So, of course, if that gets compromised, they have access to a lot of things. But we do have a few tips that consumers can be aware of to make sure that they can protect themselves from it. The first is, if you're going to use with one of these, look at the cord quickly and make sure that it doesn't appear to be tampered with. Also, what we can do is choose the charge only feature on your phone. There is one usually when you plug into a cord like that, or even sometimes in your car, you'll see, do you want to share your contacts? Do you want to share data? Do you want to just charge? Using charge only should have the software shut off access to those other areas of the phone that you don't want to give access to. Also, there's devices that consumers can get. It's a USB data blocker that you attach to the end of the cable. And then when you do so, it really just restricts it from only being able to charge. It doesn't allow any data to be transferred back and forth, which is a great little tool to use, especially if you're traveling a lot and traveling overseas and might need to be using some of these portable data chargers. And then the last is just...
What's the name of that again?
It's a data blocker.
Data blocker.
Yep. So if you just search USB data blocker, you'll come up with all kinds of different options. And then the last is just bringing your own, your cord, you know, using those outlets and using your plug into the wall that you have with you, and then saying, okay, you know what, I know that this cord is trustworthy. I know most of those general wall outlets are difficult to compromise. And so you can feel confident that you're charging it at the right space and safely.
Yeah. I have purchased a while back when I went to Scotland, I wanted to make sure I had power, so I bought one of these little devices that is a charger. You charge it up at home, and then you can just plug that in. Nothing's going to happen if you're doing that, I don't think.
Not that we're aware of. That really doesn't have the ability to hold any data itself. It's just a pure charging mechanism. You know, and that's the other thing, too, is if you have the option, and the safest way is using those three-pronged plugs, because those usually don't transfer a lot of data, but we see a lot of airports, even airplanes, where they're having the USB-C or the USB chargers, and you're just putting a cable into them. I mean, planes and public things, I trust all of those. But just making sure that if you're in a place and you're like, I'm not quite sure if this is going to be transferring data, maybe just wait a second if you can.
Kathy in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. I was going to ask about... I almost got scammed out of money through my credit union, and it was because they had all my information from credit reports. So this is a little bit different, but I have gone in, since I don't need to apply for credit for anything, I have frozen my credit with all three credit bureaus, and I just wondered how much protection that actually offers.
Yeah.
That's the best tool that we talk about for consumers to use, because it locks down your credit report, and no one can take out any extensions of credit in your name using your information without your authorization and approval. So you've done the safest thing that we have available to us with data that someone else controls in houses. So great job.
And somebody's going to ask right away, well, what about my credit card? Can I use my credit card if I've frozen my credit?
Wonderful question. Yes, you can use your credit card, because this is locking it down at the major credit reporting agencies who compile all the data about you and decide if you are what level of extension of credit they want to issue for you. I mean, so this impacts when you need to get utilities at your residence. This impacts if a new credit card, a loan with your bank. Some insurance companies will look at this as well, and some employers. But it's locking down that information and background checks about you until you authorize the release of the extension of credit. Some of the background can still be done, but no one can say, okay, let's issue another credit card or a loan or anything that you would be responsible for without your authorization.
Yeah. Kathy, a great question. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Recovery scams, kind of another general area. I think people who try to retrieve money lost to a scammer, sometimes at risk of being victimized again.
They are. And this is a variation when we've talked in the past about, you know, scams, snowballing scams, where it starts at one area and then they kind of build upon that and build upon and build upon. This is kind of a two-step process where the scammer reaches out after probably the same person had been their target and said, hey, we know that you lost some money and we're here to help. And oftentimes it's the same person and they know that. And so they have a few details that help the particular consumer say, hey, you know what? I believe that this is real, because how else would they know this? In the example we had a consumer reach out and they had lost, you know, $5,000 in a cryptocurrency scam. And they were contacted by what they thought was a reputable company that had name recognition, had a website, was well known to assist with situations like this. And they said they could get their money back, that they would just need $500, and then they could transfer through this platform, which they thought was legitimate. You know, and it goes back to what we were talking earlier about Benjamin, where the platform looked exactly like the real one did. Yeah. The web address seemed very similar. So this consumer did transfer that $500, and what they realized shortly after is that that company really wasn't going to help them. A couple of red signs or red flags came up that helped them turn it around, but most notably, when they were going through, they said, okay, wait a second. If I was supposed to get this money back right away, why did it happen right away? Crypto's instantaneous. This didn't happen. Where did it go? But scammers rely on that. They rely on that quick emotional reaction to saying, oh my gosh, I lost this money. Who can fix it for me? And when somebody reaches out and you don't take a minute, you're thinking, great, the saving grace is here. They can do so. But be cautious. Be cautious when suddenly, if you did happen to send money and you've realized that, recognize that there may be a secondary, we're just going to call a secondary attack that's going to say, and we're going to try and get some more money from you. Those unsolicited offers, just like anything, you want to be cautious of those, but especially if they're saying, hey, we can help you even further, because how would they really know that? You know, it's tough to get some of that information. And especially be skeptical if anyone's asking for those upfront fees. If they're saying, hey, we need you to pay us more money in order for us to get it back, that should be a caution flag for you, because most reputable companies will offer an opportunity to at least show you how they can help before demanding that money right away. And then lastly, and we want to emphasize this on a few areas, but if the money is sent to the scammer through a cryptocurrency kiosk, just please recognize that there is a new law that was put into place that gives them an opportunity to potentially recover that money. That law says that, you know, if you can show that the money was sent to a scammer and as part of fraud, and if you file a complaint with the kiosk vendor and law enforcement or the Department of Financial Institutions or the Department of Justice, one of those three, within 30 days, there's an opportunity for you to get that money back. And this is an incredibly new opportunity for those who did send money to have a chance to get it back where before they didn't.
And cryptocurrency, just as an aside, I don't think I'll ever do it because I really haven't learned it. I feel like a complete idiot or lack of knowledge. Let's put it that way. I imagine there's all kinds of opportunities for all kinds of scams relating to crypto.
Absolutely. And the scammers are banking on that. They are counting on people not having familiarity, not realizing that this is not a regulated currency, and that different states didn't have regulations in place to really help combat. And we're thankful that this is now in place in Wisconsin, this $1,000 a day transaction limit, warning signs on the kiosks in order to tell people to not continue to pay if they're told to pay this way. And we've seen that 98% of transactions that happened through cryptocurrency kiosks were related to fraud. That's according to a study done out of Iowa and with the U.S. Department of Justice. So really significant usage by scammers. And that's why this notification, this dollar limit, this 30 days to file your complaint can be really helpful to consumers and hopefully combat the scammers with another tool.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good law to me. Ellen in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you for the program this morning. Can you tell me if a flip phone is any less vulnerable to scammers than a phone like a smartphone or an iPhone that accepts email and internet and so on? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you so much.
Okay. I don't...
That's a tough one. Yeah. Is it less vulnerable? Because it's about the engagement that we have. So a smartphone's going to contain more data because you're going to connect with apps and you're going to store things and you can access social media. So they have another entry point to you. A flip phone, you can still receive text messages, you still receive phone calls, and if you engage with that scammer, then the phone is still the entry point.
Still a phone.
Yeah, but will it contain your data if you text that data across the way? But it's not going to, most flip phones won't have apps, but there are now modern day flip phones that still are smartphone devices. So it depends if you're talking about the original flip phone that just lets you text and call, or if you're talking about a smartphone flip phone. So you have to just evaluate the phone in that information.
I completely agree. I think the only difference that I would highlight between the two is that smartphones typically have the ability to connect via Wi-Fi, and your flip phones don't. And so that would be a potential, really the only different risk point and the access point where they could get to all the things Michelle just talked about. You have the apps, you have the data on the smartphone, so it's a bigger treasure trove for them to access versus the flip phone, which daily doesn't have much.
Yeah. Ellen, does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Scammers are often using they're impersonating organizations, as we've already found out here today on several occasions, because they can look just like the real thing. Barcodes, though, it took me a while to figure out how to even use a barcode on my phone. I'll be perfectly honest about it. I can use one now. But how are some scammers using barcodes to convince people they're legit and stealing their money?
Yeah, well, this one is not brand new, but it's new to Wisconsin. We're getting reports from consumers that it is now circulating in our state, and we've seen it primarily with the utility scam, the cold call from utility providers saying you owe money. But what happens is that scammer impersonates this trusted organization, and then they make up a reason why the consumer will owe them money, and then they send a barcode to them using text or email. They tell you to take this barcode to a reputable, well-known, legitimate retail store, scan it at one of the payment kiosks or a checkout aisle, and then make the payment that comes up, so that necessary payment. So this type of payment, barcode use, it has legitimate purposes. You can get a barcode from your healthcare provider after you've confirmed an appointment and they tell you to scan in when you get there. You might want to load your cryptocurrency wallet if you are an investor in that. Cash apps, PayPal, eCash, that's legitimate uses for barcode. But when a scammer is sending it to you from something that's out of the blue, saying you owe a company and need to pay this way, that's just putting the money that you pay into the scammer's wallet. versus your own when you're making it that way. So it's convenient, it's easy. That's what they're saying, you know, no problem. And because it hasn't been talked about by us a whole lot, it's not on the red flag list yet.
Yeah.
And so consumers don't realize that this too is a red flag, and we need to get the message out there, because everything that scammer's telling you is just a big old fat lie. You know?
Well, and if you have to go someplace...
Well, there's inconvenience to that, but you had to go someplace to pay when you were told to use the cryptocurrency machine. You had to go someplace to wire the money. You had to go someplace for other things. So they get you into the emotional, urgent, that social engineering and manipulation that Michael talked about earlier, that you forget that it's inconvenient and you have to do something. But really, they are, again, are just trying to get around all the messaging that we do and use this new methodology.
I would also add, Larry, to your point about going someplace, in turn, that actually adds a little bit of legitimacy to the scam, because they're going to known retailers that we probably shop at regularly. And so if you're going in, you wouldn't suspect that they would be able to assist in facilitating the fraud. You think this retailer, which I know is legitimate and on the up and up, if they're scanning it, it must be real. In reality, it's not.
Well, Paul in Toma has something for us. Let's go there. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I would like to comment that you can get a notification on your real estate. If anybody tries to file a quitclaim deed or something against your property, you will be notified of that. I have a friend in Idaho whose employee got a restraining order filed against him through his ex-wife. She was trying to get him thrown in prison. Then as an employee, she would then sign forged quitclaim deeds against his real estate, selling the property before he ever got out of jail. We had the FBI involved, and they said he was her ninth victim that she had done this to, and they did nothing about it. So I would highly recommend, it's super easy online. You list your name and on your account here, wherever, and if anybody tries to file anything against your real estate, you will be notified that something was just recorded.
No. Paul, thanks for calling. Comment on that, Michael.
I do. This is a question that has come up at our outreach presentations that we give all the time, and it got to the point where we actually added a little bit of information within that presentation to jump ahead of it and address it. And, you know, it's home title theft is certainly a concern throughout the country, but each state has different laws, and some may make it a little bit, I'm not going to say easier to facilitate, but there might not be as many safeguards put in place. Wisconsin does have a few, but the one thing we always echo that Paul said is reaching out to the local county clerk and the clerk of deeds and asking, do they have any opportunities for these type of notifications? Many counties in Wisconsin are aware that this is happening. They're putting these options in place so that you can have it. And then also reaching out to the mortgage company and asking them, what opportunities do you have to be notified should anything be done on the deed? And so Paul has great advice in saying, look, check out what these free options are. I will say the risk of this happening, of somebody just arbitrarily without your knowledge stealing your home, you know, refinancing it, getting that title, that all starts with identity theft. Like, they have to have a lot of information about you, and they also have to have the ability to forge a lot of the documents and do so convincingly. And so I'm not saying it's impossible. It's difficult to do, but it does start with identity theft. And so if you're paying attention to those other red flags, it might help you ward this off. But I would, again, follow Paul's advice. Reach out to your local county clerk reports where you have property listed, see what they have, and then take advantage of it.
Yeah. And as Paul said, the one gal had done it 9 times.
That's wild.
It's absolutely wild. Thank you very much for that, Paul. I really appreciate it. Mike in Poinette has something. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. I'm in the process of selling my truck, and I posted it on Craigslist and put my phone number on there because I like to talk to people rather than text or email, just because I do. Anyhow, I had a guy who was very interested, asked me all kinds of questions. We went back and forth several times. Absolutely interested in the car.
You're breaking up.
Time to meet.
You're breaking up. I'm sorry, Mike. So he wanted, from what I was gathering, the guy wanted, there was a meeting that was scheduled.
Well, it sounded like they wanted to meet, but I'm guessing what he was going to say is the guy probably couldn't meet. And so maybe he was going to pay or, you know, write a check to hold the car, and could he probably ship the car or something. That's usually the type of scam we see through Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist and different things. When you post something, the scammer will reach out interested but have all sorts of reasons why they can't actually meet in person. And it might be they're in a different state, or it might be the timing and job-related issues. But they offer to pay and have you ship the product. They'll pay. You'll get the check. Usually it'll be for more money than what you've asked for. There'll be another connection saying, okay, some of that's for the compensation because I'm having you ship the vehicle, but I also just made a mistake. Can you give me more money back? You cash the check weeks later after you've sent the car and you've paid the extra money and for the shipping of the vehicle, the check is no good. It's a fake check. And so you end up losing your money that way. That's my gut assumption as to where this was going with him. You know, we always really encourage people to do everything you can to vet that it's legitimate. And this is whether you're buying something or whether you are selling it. When you're selling it, you run the risk of losing your product and some of your money, and because you'll get paid and the check will bounce. And there's usually an overpayment aspect to that. But when you're buying, you're handing over your money and run the risk of entirely losing out on receiving the product that you're purchasing because it doesn't really exist. So lots of different ways to navigate that, using an escrow account when you're purchasing, staying on the platform, and don't ever move communications off that platform to a different one that they want. Make sure you do everything to check out the seller or the buyer's credibility with that platform and other platforms as well. And whenever you can, if it is from another state and you're not going to go there, you know, ask for a live tour. You know, hook up to say, okay, let's do a FaceTime and let me see that vehicle. Run the engine. I don't want just photographs of it, because those can be digitally, you know, with artificial intelligence developed in things. So a lot of different steps that you can take.
Richard in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
What happened to you? What's on your mind?
Well, it was ugly. We went on a cruise, and we shut our phones down. And in the meantime, someone had stolen mail out of our mailbox at our house and got a picture of our passport, made a fake passport, and had a fake driver's license. They went in online and held our mail, went to the post office and said, "Hi, I'm Richard. Here's my driver's license. I want to pick up my mail I've got on hold." So they got into my wife's information as well. Then they went to a phone place in Green Bay and said they were me. They had a fake passport and said they were me, wanted a new phone because all the information is gone. They lost it and want a new phone. So they gave them a new phone with all my information on it. So they got into everything, our investments, our credit cards, loans, everything. We finally got it all settled, but basically the police said, "Well, no, there's nothing we can do." And I said, "Well, isn't it a federal offense, monkeying with the mail?" "Well, they take care of their cell. That isn't something we can do." So bottom line is we froze everything and everything and canceled any credit cards that we weren't using. And I still get things in the mail for, like, LifeLock and those kinds of things that they claim they watch it better and can get into your dark web-type stuff and clean it up. But after all of this, I don't know if I trust any of these places, and some of them get pretty pricey, so.
Yeah. Comments?
Well, Go ahead.
I'll just start with a couple and then I'll let you carry forward. One thing I just want to kind of highlight and that Richard was talking about is we spend so much time talking about computers and phones and technology and things, and we forget about kind of the basics and how most of this started, you know, in this mailbox. And mm-hmm. how much information. And if you take a second after the show today and think about all the things that you get in the mail and what information is on there, it's a lot of the things that we talk about protecting when we have text messages or online apps. And certainly our social isn't being sent, and a lot of businesses don't do that, but there's enough other information that you can put together a pretty good profile about what's happening. I will say a few of the things that happened, Richard, kind of made my eyes widen of like, I can't, this is a high level of identity theft. There's a lot of things going on here and a very concerted effort to exploit this one particular identity. Usually we just see a little bit here and there. They try and maybe get a credit card number and make some purchases, but the level of detail that went into exploiting kind of Richard's identity is kind of surprising. I will just also mention on LifeLock, the question we always get about, is it worth it? And we really don't answer that because it's down to a matter of kind of risk management or how much level of effort do you want to put into monitoring your own identity. A lot of the things that LifeLock offers, most consumers can do on their own. It just takes time and it takes the investment in doing, though. And so it's a decision to make of, do I want to do this or do I want to let somebody else do it for me? And he's right. Some of them can be expensive, but then it's a matter of convenience. It's, do I want to or do I want them to do it? So I'll just lead with that and let Michelle.
Yeah.
The only
thing
I'd add to what Michael just said is just remember that you're having to hand over your information to whatever company you hire, and now they have it in control. So what is their protection method of maintaining your own information as well?
Yeah.
So weighing all those factors.
And then one thing I'll close with is we can assist with identity theft recovery. And so we do a lot of preventative education out here on shows and such, but Richard sounds like he was, putting some of those pieces together, but also, at Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, one of the things that we offer is identity theft recovery. We have relationships with the lenders and the creditors, and we use those to help try and put some of the pieces back in place. We can't always put all of them, but we certainly can help talk through some other areas that consumers might not be thinking about that may have been exploited also. And so we can kind of try and dampen the ripple effect of that one incident.
And worth mentioning that it's a couple of ways to do it. You call 1-800-422-7128, 422-7128, or go to datcp.wi.gov. We've been doing this long enough, I can pretty much spin that right out of my head.
Well done, Larry. Well
perfect.
Done.
Oh, man. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, our guests. You can join in, too. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking consumer scams today and getting a lot of great information from our guests today, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. It's great to have them with us. And we're also getting some great calls with a lot of interesting stories to tell here. I appreciate that very, very much. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Joel in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks so much. So this has happened three times that I know about, two times in California and one time out here in Wisconsin, and it would be one of our elderly relatives, it could be an aunt or the grandparents, getting a call, a frantic call from a grandson or the nephew saying, hey, Grammy, I'm locked up. They put me in jail and I need, $500 to get bailed out. Can you wire the money? And they know some details about it, not fully. And so people are initially fooled. And then maybe in one instance, they asked more questions and kind of figured it out. And I don't know exactly. Maybe there might have been one instance where they actually did wire the money. And so my question is, how do these scammers get that level of information, or what can we tell our elderly family members to watch out for?
Yeah. Go ahead, Michelle.
Really appreciate the call, Joel, and the story there of what can happen. But This is certainly advanced over time. So when this scam first started, they were in a car crash and it was law enforcement calling on behalf of the relative, or the relative indicated they had a broken nose and that's why they sounded different. This scam's advancing with artificial intelligence because now they can use voice cloning and sound just like that relative and have a complete conversation. And they're getting data from social media, from online profiles that are out there and not locked down from the public, from just data mining in general, and compiling data from all the different digital footprints that are out there about individuals and piecing that together. And we've seen where scammers take the time to piece all these puzzle pieces together to advance these scams and continue them forward. So they do have a time investment on their side with their, quote, craft, if you will, of trying to rip people off. But they certainly are just advancing that and then selling that information to the next scammer and the next scammer when they've proven that it can be successful in trying to take advantage of someone. And the way we say to combat this or try and combat it is to make sure that you have a family passphrase or password, if you will, that when a family member is traveling, have open communication about that. Don't keep secrets that you're going on a cruise just because someone else will be jealous. Mm-hmm. And communicate that, but then set up that family passphrase that will only be known by those members. It's not something that's available on social media. It's not, you know, your first pet's name and that's also out there with photos. Something that will only be contained to the family that they can then share to confirm whether or not this emergency is legitimate or if it's just a scammer.
I like that idea.
And Joel perfectly illustrated the earlier conversation we had when Rod called about his mom, who liked to just have conversations, and we understand, but unknowingly, she might be creating the exact scenario we're talking about of providing all that information.
Yeah. Joel, thank you very much. Stephanie and Madison, we'll go to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. So I actually had an incident last Thursday. I got a text message. I just started a cleaning business last month here in Dane County, and they asked me about my services. I told them I'm based out of Dane County. They asked if I can do a job in Mount Horeb. They would send me a check for $2,600, and I would pay a landscaper, and then they started asking me about Zelle and my bank info. So it was just kind of a new thing for me to see someone trying to contact me for my business and trying to scam that way.
Yeah.
And Stephanie, this is not uncommon for us to hear about. A lot of our time is, you know, spent talking about consumers, but we also make a concerted effort to make sure businesses are aware of what's going on, because consumers are not just isolated. Scammers are exploiting every opportunity they can. Earlier, when we were talking about the barcode scam and the utility, that individual has reached out connection to his business. And it was his business that had what they said was the delinquent utility bill. And so, of course, they don't want the business to have the lights go out and need electricity. So you're prone, sometimes even more than us as consumers, to quickly react to that because your livelihood depends on it. And so not only are we see scenarios where there's check overpayments, which sounds like it may be the case of what's happening with Stephanie, or prepayments where a service is going to be provided and that check doesn't work out, or through Zelle trying to get that payment information and then exploiting that. Businesses are another opportunity. And one of the misnomers that I want to dispel quickly also is when we talk to businesses, or even there's a perception that if you're a small business, you're not really a great target for scammers, and that's very untrue. Oftentimes people think, well, they're only going after the big businesses because they have more information or more money, or you know, that pot of gold is a lot bigger. But in reality, smaller businesses may have less resources, may not have an IT team, may not have individuals that can screen this through and potentially become more vulnerable. And, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 credit card numbers is still valuable. Yeah. And so that's why we want to make sure all businesses do their due diligence.
Very good points. And Stephanie, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Many callers online, and we will get to you with our guest. Michelle Reinen is the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke, director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. They will be with us right to the bottom of the hour today. Later on, we'll take up extended warranties with another guest. But for now, stay with us, and we get another half hour to answer your questions. We'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are looking at identifying scams before you fall for them. And we have our regular guest, Michelle Reinen, administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke, director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Lots of callers online, and I think we'll just go right to the phones here. Stephanie and Madison, what can we do for you?
Hi, Larry. I got to see you last night, so thanks for all that you're doing for this show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I came on late. Yeah, I came on late, and so I didn't hear kind of the beginning kind of spiel, but I know that you mentioned LifeLock and that they offer services for folks who don't want to monitor this themselves. So I'm curious, what are some things, you know, if I don't want to pay for a service, what should I be doing regularly kind of to protect my identity, and like what different systems can I how regular should I check them, and what can I be monitoring?
Yeah. Stephanie, thanks. And thanks for coming last night. Just as an aside, I was at the Barrymore Theater with a pretty much full house of people, and it was my last kind of talk about my history of working here at WPR for 59 years. It was a lot of fun. But now to Stephanie's actual question, what should she be doing, or anybody else doing, if they don't want to do that, have somebody else do it for you?
Yeah, this is a great question, and Michael and I are going to love sharing it. So first, I'm going to say go to our website and get our identity theft fact sheet. That we have a tips one, and it's going to bullet point a lot of what we're going to say. So go to datcp.wi.gov and grab that. But you first would want to run your credit report and monitor and check your credit report. You can do that on a weekly basis if you do it electronically, or you can still do it the old-fashioned way and have it mailed to you, and then you can do it once a year from each of the three credit reporting agencies. But order your credit report and examine it. Next, you're going to want to, it's monitoring, 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 monitoring. You're going to want to monitor your credit card bills, your bank statements. You want to check your Social Security statement once a year. You want to examine and check your medical explanation of benefits when you've had a doctor's appointment and confirm and verify no one has actually had a doctor's appointment using your medical information and maybe changed your medical history there. You want to check your driver's license history to be sure someone doesn't have a copy or isn't using that and getting tickets and violations in your name. Let's see. What else, Michael?
That's good. I was thinking that's perfect of what you can actively do. And I was looking at some other tools that LifeLock in regards to locking things down and what features and programs actually state agencies and federal agencies offer. Mm-hmm. For instance, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, the DMV offers e-notify. And what that does is by signing up anytime anyone tries to make a change to your driver's license or your license, your vehicle record, you get notified. And so that's a quick heads up to it. We have informed delivery by USPS. And what that is you sign up for that and it sends you an email with a scan of all the mail that should be in your mailbox. And so if that's not there, the Department of Revenue offers a PIN system. So when you're filing taxes or making changes, you have to enter that PIN. And so that's an added level of security. And so it's just a few things like this. There's many more in the tips sheet that Michelle mentioned that you can do to put on the front end that LifeLock might suggest, but you can actually do yourself. And then if you follow through and do the active monitoring on all the things Michelle was mentioning, boy, you're going to cover a lot of it.
Yeah, you can opt out of receiving credit card offers and mail and having your name released from the Department of Transportation on their lists. And anywhere you have an opportunity to opt out, sharing banking information with affiliates and things. So there's lots of opt out opportunities with just having companies you do business with share that information with their affiliates and always be taking advantage of those. That minimizes your footprint.
And then you can pay, in addition to that, some of that mailings that you receive or junk mail, you can pay to have a lot of that reduced, which of course reduces the chance that somebody might steal your mail and exploit some of that information.
Yeah. Stephanie, lots to do there. Thank you so much for calling. And hey, thanks for showing up last night, too. It was a lot of fun. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for calling.
Good. First time caller. I love your show, and I'm going to miss you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. My thing that happened to us about 3 months ago is we got notification on our phone that a big distribution company was sending stuff to our home, to our address. And so we ended up, calling them up. You know, we were able to cancel some of the items that were being shipped. And then we also did not have to pay for those items, changed our password. And lo and behold, the next day it happened all over again. And this went on for about 3 or 4 times. And we kept changing our password and it just didn't help. And so finally we decided we went back to the company and said we just want to cancel our credit card, be done with it. And we did reopen a new one, and that seemed to take care of it. But the scammers were sending stuff to our house. So how are they benefiting from sending stuff to us?
Yeah.
So this is a scam called brushing, and it's done for a couple reasons. First is they're going to send product to an address, and in doing so, it's going to kind of perceive to be a confirmed delivery. And then this is used on sales platforms in these big marketplaces where it's going to look like these are confirmed sales because they can show to the marketplace, look, there's a confirmed delivery. And so then that increases what it looks like, customer contacts. And of course, then it says, you know, you and I go on there and we look at it, and if we're choosing between two vendors, we're saying, well, one shows 10 deliveries and the other one has 1,000. Well, the other one seems like it's probably going to be more reliable. And so that's going to drive that there. The other is the opportunity when you have confirmed deliveries, there's an opportunity to leave a review. And a lot of us really, you know, kind of depend on these reviews. And so if a platform allows a confirmed delivery to leave a review, then these scam, well, not always scammers, but sometimes legitimate businesses who are exploiting this through the brushing act will then have the opportunity to leave a review. And then they get the 5-star rating. We choose to go with them. And so a couple of reasons that this might be happening.
Yeah. And we've also seen a new twist to the brushing scam where the outside of the box will contain a QR code that they encourage you to then activate that QR code using your phone device, and they'll ask for your personal information. Sometimes they'll ask for a payment. So they're just trying to advance the scam one more step and try and take advantage of you directly as opposed to using your information to take advantage of you indirectly. So always a twist, always something new with this. But it's very difficult for the consumer who goes out there and shops for the next thing to decide what's a real review and what's a fake review, and trying to navigate that space and understand how to confidently rely on the information you're finding. And there's different tips for analyzing a fake review or reviews in general. And you want to look for confirmed verified sales. Real names, not names that are John Smith and Jane Doe type names. Make sure that they're actual names and not numbers and codes looking like the names. Look for real information about the product or the service as opposed to stories and experiences in the location that they've had, because that can all just be made up. And of course, grammar. We're always looking for the grammatical issues, but not everyone spells well either. So we have to give and take on that.
So lots there. Ann, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Janesville, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Love your show. You'll be missed, but I'm sure they'll continue on. My concern is I work for a state agency, and we're drilled on email security, looking for fake emails and that. And on my personal email, I get on a regular basis, sometimes daily, emails that in the address, it has a name of someone that I know, or in the body of the text, it has something. I know how to hover over it to see what the real sender's email is, but how concerned should I be for emails that contain contact and people that are in my purview, but they're using that name to make it seem legit? Should I be doing something different, or?
Yeah, to safeguard against it. Yeah, not much you can do, is there?
Well, if they've accessed legitimate information, it sounds like there may have been a compromise at some point with a contacts list.
Yeah.
And so I think you could proactively just reach out to your contacts and say, this may have happened. Just be aware if you get a weird email from me that's asking for anything that's out of the norm, please don't respond to it or just give me a call. But a proactive outreach on that wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen a lot of proactive outreaches lately because certainly church communities are being impacted where the pastor's email is being compromised, or different small groups, community groups you might belong to, theirs can be, and then you get the email to click this link to sign up for the potluck that's on Tuesday, or an invitation to attend the whatever gathering. And those aren't legit. They're not coming from and they're encouraging. So part of it is also recognizing what is really happening from that friend, and do they just want you to click the link? It's a short, hey, check out these photos, and then here's the link. Well, what photos? We didn't do anything. You need more context and information, and that's when you call your friend or you text your friend and say, did you send me that email? No. Well, I've gotten something from you, and to what Michael said, that informs, so they can let everyone else know that the information's been compromised.
Yeah, good points all. Bob, thank you. Sherry in Richland Center, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I seem to be a target for so many issues, and I've had an identity theft in the past that I took care of. But what I notice is, like, at least 3 times a year, I get a letter from some business saying that my data has been compromised. Like, the last one was TransUnion. They said my birth date and social security number had been stolen, you know, and then they say, oh, you know, we'll give you a year of whatever LifeLock type of thing. But like, none of my friends or family seem to have this issue happening to them. So I'm like, is there something that I need to pay attention to?
Michael,
as to why this happens?
The tips are the same no matter who we are. I will say, though, depending on how widespread your presence is, whether it be online, whether it be with apps, wherever you're logging into, certainly is going to increase the opportunity for scammers to exploit that. And so, I have the same situation where I have a very limited exposure to social media and so on, but I have a lot of friends that are kind of all over and out there, and they receive far more inquiries and far more letters than I do. But that's just based on numbers. There's just more opportunities for that information to be accessed or exploited. I would say pay the notices that you're receiving. Unfortunately, I would just do a little bit extra research when you're getting those to make sure they're legitimate. We are aware of scammers sending out fake notices that says it's a data breach and then guiding you to where you can log in and access some of these free services. At the same time, there's a lot of states have requirements for businesses to notify consumers when their information has been compromised. And so you have to be able to sort through the real ones and the fake ones to kind of get a feel for what it is. But to your question of why you're receiving more, I can only assume that it just may be you might be out there a little bit more in regards to how you're taking advantage of, you know, apps, programs, websites, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes some sense. Sherry, thank you for calling. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. So my question is regarding these insurance claims. So we had all this hail damage in southern Wisconsin, and I've heard this from a lot of people, and I'm assuming thousands of people are affected. But I've been receiving about 40-plus calls a day for months now. And as of last week, it's down to like 30 calls a day. And I'm wondering, did State Farm sell off my insurance information, or how did I get on these lists, and how do I get off of these lists?
All right. Well, Michelle has the answers.
Well, Mike, thank you for calling in. I just love that you did, because this is a real issue for me in the last few months and a half as well, because I'm getting those calls too. And I don't think your information's been sold. It's just they are calling the vicinity where these storms happened. Wisconsin was hit hard, so pretty much any number in the state. So these individuals buy lead lists. They're called lead generation lists, and they can just, the phone banks can just then call on auto dialers. Are they supposed to be? No. If you are on the do not call list and you are receiving these calls, I beg of you to please file a complaint. We have a fast track form that's about 5 questions that you can complete online to report this so we can go after these companies that are making these phone calls to individuals who are on the do not call list, because giving a free estimate for a roof assessment or doing an evaluation of your windows or siding, that's considered a scheme that's tied to a solicitation and is not permitted under the Wisconsin Do Not Call regulation. And we also need to verify that these individuals calling have registered as telemarketers in our state. So Michael's over here smiling and snickering away because this is my issue right now. And, you know, I beg of you to file those complaints and just go on datcp.wi.gov. And for each one, fill out the phone number that they called and the phone number that they called you from, if you have it, and whatever company name that they're using.
And again, that's datcp.wi.gov. I gave it too fast earlier in the show, and somebody said, hey, would you repeat that website? datcp.wi.gov. Or you could call, too, 1-800-422-7128. I think you'll probably mail one out, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. We'll mail out a complaint form. The one online is just real short.
For that matter,
he can just email us and report it as well, and certainly that information will get entered in the system and followed up on.
Mike, thanks very much for calling. When a pet gets lost, and my own cat managed to get out once, and when it's missing, the owner, of course, was going to seek help from the neighborhood or the public to find it. And you can fall victim to a scammer in this way.
You can. And this is just another one of those heartbreaking stories of how scammers take advantage of vulnerable and emotional situations. And here what we're seeing now is where the pet owner is publicly posting about losing their companion, and then the scammer is reaching out to them at that phone number, that website, that email, that social media post. And they can claim to be a few things. At first, they might claim to be a pet service who can help that pet owner find their pet for a fee. They may say that they found the pet, but they need money to ship that pet back because they found it, you know, so far away, or they're not there anymore, but they brought the pet with them. Or they say that, you know, the pet is injured, it's been sick, they found it, but they're going to need some help paying for those veterinary expenses because they also had the best interest and wanted to get that pet all fixed up right away, and now they need the money to recover that. Or they might actually just say they stole the pet and that they have it, and now they want money in order to return. And so all of these play on the emotions and the desire for the pet owner to certainly try and get their loved companion back. What they're going to rely on, though, is that their ability to say, I'm not going to think about what's happening. They're going to give in to that sudden, immediate desire to say, I want the pet back and I'm willing to do anything that it takes. And they're going to not quite think about, well, what are the protective steps I need to take, and trying to separate the emotion with the logic, which is very, very difficult to do, and why the scam can be successful. First thing I want everyone to do, if you do end up in the situation, is never send the money up front. Please make sure you get some type of information that shows, hey, you can confirm that you have your pet. Now, be aware that AI can make this a little bit easy to do, because if you posted a picture of it, they can manipulate that picture pretty easily to create a scenario which says, you know, I'm showing that your pet's healthy, or that it needed care, or that I have it. But then also looking for any pet service that says, hey, if we can get this, just do some background search on it. Like we recommend everyone with a company, take a minute, make sure it's legitimate before you sign up or provide any money.
Are there services like that out there?
There are a few of them that do this. You know, some of them are local. Some of them are a little bit bigger. Not many, but there certainly are businesses that are out there to help with this situation.
Amazing. I understand a Wisconsin resident contacted you folks about somebody impersonating a landlord on a housing website. What happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. So this consumer was seeking a place to move to, and the scammer had posted a fake rental listing on a very popular housing website, and they included their own contact information instead of the real property owner's information. So the consumer ended up contacting this scammer. They inquired about the property. They wanted to submit an application, and they were told that it would be $60 per adult for an application fee before they could even tour the property. So there's the catch. The consumer was able to avoid this scam because they acknowledged that they could have been just talking to a scammer, first of all. But then they also were skeptical of the fact that they weren't able to tour this property. And so they asked to talk to the landlord in person via the phone to get more details. They were denied that. They'd asked additional questions about the property that went unanswered, like utilities and appliances, again, about the tour dates, more inquiries about this application fee, and none of that was answered. So they did some more research and investigation of the property and the rental company. They used the satellite map and street views and, you know, municipal offices and property records, all these things that are available to consumers, and they were able to avoid this. They didn't send the application fee, and they reported it to us. So then here at DadCap, we could work with the platform to get the posting taken down and reported that as a scammer. But this is just a reminder that we need to be vigilant as consumers when we're shopping online, because it's certainly where we're losing a lot of our money to scams, and do our due diligence in our research and question what's in front of us, and don't just take it at face value, and recognize that when something seems too good to be true or suspicious or your spidey senses go off, whatever it is, pay attention to that. Recognize that you could be involved with a scammer.
You guys, I ask you a lot. I've asked you a lot of questions over time, but I understand you have a question for me as well.
Well, we're going to give you a choice of a question because, you know, we have many questions, but we're going to give you the host choice of, you know, what was your most memorable consumer protection caller and why, and what did you learn from it? Or what habits have you changed from all the years and all the conversations we've had about consumer protection issues? And, you know, what will you take with you into your retirement?
Oh, man. Well, I remember one call that was just awful. And it was a woman who called, and they had somehow, somebody had gotten into her banking account and took all of the money out of her account. And not only did that, she had, like, you could get, she could have a $3,000, you know, loan just on the face of it.
Remember that.
And they took all of her money, and then they borrowed $3,000 out of it.
Insult to injury, yeah.
Yeah, which was this is the most heart-rending thing because it was a younger person, but had a fair amount of money and lost it, which I tell you made me a lot more cautious when it came to my own banking. And the one thing that I've really done, two-factor authentication is something that I get on everything that will allow me to. And I've learned a whole lot over the years, and I want to thank you guys very much.
Well, thank you, Larry. You have really helped so many consumers across the nation through this program. I mean, not just Wisconsin, and it has been a joy.
It has. And I have to tell you, Larry, each time we're out there talking to audiences, it is not uncommon to hear, I heard you on Larry. It's so great that you guys have the opportunity and he lets you share all that stuff. So you've been an incredible advocate for us.
Thank you both. Michelle Reinand, Administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke, Director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer protection. This is one show I'm going to miss hosting a lot. I'll miss them all, but this one is in particular. We've had a great relationship over time. But we're kind of still dealing in the consumer protection area. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at extended warranties. I've got my own story to tell with that, and that'll be next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Turning our attention to extended warranties. Do you need them, or do you buy one when you're buying your product? You think you need it? Larry Mueller here, WPR News, and joined by Liam McCabe. Liam is a writer who covers home improvement for Wirecutter. It's a consumer products review site. It's owned by the New York Times. And had them on in the past from Wirecutter. They do a nice job and have some really good stories. And I'm wondering about you. I think I'm having a television set installed on my wall and at home. My other one kind of went to pieces a little bit. So I bought one. And frankly, I'm glad my daughter is, one of my daughters is home. Because you have to have somebody there, of course, when something like that happens. But the person who sold me the TV set spent a lot of time talking with me about purchasing an extended warranty. And it's a fairly expensive little proposition I'm into here. And it made me kind of think about it. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do it. I'm going to take my chances. And I think Liam's got a lot of great information that sort of confirmed my own thoughts on this. Liam, welcome, by the way. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you wrote a story earlier this month for Wirecutter that appeared in the New York Times and questioning the value of extended warranties. How did you wind up tackling this topic, or why did you?
Well, I had a period a few years ago really getting into personal finance just to kind of get my own house in order. And I had heard a few times that these are generally a losing proposition, and kept that in the back of my mind as something to write about. And as I was working on some other projects, I had mentioned this to a few people I worked with, and a lot of people were resistant to the idea that the math was as bad as it actually turns out to be. And I found that fascinating too. Like why when the numbers seem so poor, do people still psychologically kind of cling to this as a form of protection against, you know, unwanted outcomes or loss of money?
Yeah. How often do people do it?
It's pretty common. So the best estimates I've heard are it's about 30% of electronics purchases end up getting an extended warranty attached to them. I think for certain categories like smartphones, it ends up being more than that, closer to 65 or 70%, according to some estimates. And, you know, Apple Care in particular is really big business for Apple. It's, you know, tens of millions of products are covered by that.
So what makes these protection plans so attractive?
Well, psychologically, I think, you know, there's something in human nature where you want your purchases to feel fair, and you want to protect yourself against potential loss. Like if you're going to spend $800 or $1,000 on a smartphone, it's going to feel bad if that thing breaks, you know, early, and you end up having to pay out of pocket to repair or replace it. So the fear of the pain of losing that expensive and important item seems to outweigh the pain of paying this protection premium, you know, whether it's a monthly payment or a lump sum when you end up buying the item in the first place.
Yeah. And How big is this industry? I mean, you mentioned with the iPhones, but it extends beyond them for sure.
Yeah, it's a large industry. Best estimates I've seen are globally, it's, you know, probably $150 billion business per year. And it's been growing and expected to grow significantly.
$150 billion. Oh, my
God. Yeah.
Well, yep. They, and as you say, they are kind of an opportunity, maybe to, you think you're buying some peace of mind. And I suppose it is sort of plying on your vulnerabilities there, but every item sold in the U.S. comes with an implied warranty, does it not? And I mean, right. Maybe talk about what that means.
Right. So legally speaking, and any item sold in the U.S., like you said, comes with what's called an implied warranty. So that's the product will do the thing that a reasonable person believes it will do for a reasonable amount of time. And that leaves some gray area. So most of the time, product manufacturers will write out the specifics. So in the written manufacturer's warranty, and they're allowed to do that. Usually that's 90 days to a year, but sometimes it can be longer. And that manufacturer's warranty typically protects against defects or poor workmanship or something like that. The extended warranty is an optional add-on. You know, like in your experience, they tried to sell you on this idea that, you know, I don't know how much your plan was, but you know, I guess it's probably around $100, $150.
That was more like close to $300.
Was it that much? Okay, yeah. It's expensive. Yeah, that would have also protected you against, you know, it would extend the amount of years that the protection applies. So it'd probably be 3 or 5 years typically. Yeah. And it would also, you know, cover you in case of accidental damage. You know, it's an extra, more comprehensive layer if you are willing to pay that premium on top of the purchase price.
I was thinking about it, and rationally, well, if it goes for 3 years or 5 years, you expect a product like I was, you know, this TV set, which is a pretty high-end one, to be perfectly honest, because I don't plan to buy another one. They're going to, it's a company that I like and respect. In fact, it's the one that I had was like 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And so if it's only 5 years or 3 years, the darn thing ought to run that long.
Yeah, you would hope. And I think the stats reflect that generally they do. You know, one of the themes that kept coming up among people, and this has been studied as well, people tend to overestimate the likelihood that something will break. You know, I don't know if this was your experience, but did the sales representative kind of like push the idea that, you know, maybe this thing may not last as long as your last one? That's a common technique I've heard.
Well, there was that.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, somehow it being damaged in the house, whether it's a cat or myself tripping or what, you know, there's all kinds of things like that that were discussed, hazards that I didn't think would ever happen, to be honest. But
Right. Yeah, and you know, there was a study done, I think, in 2018 that found for a lot of categories, not all of them, some people in some categories, people actually have a pretty good idea of a typical failure rate, but in many of them, and it's usually kind of high end electronics, people overestimate the likelihood of something going wrong by like three times what the actual likelihood really is.
Jim in Lake Geneva has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've been interested in your program because I have only taken out a few extended warranties because you're giving your money to an insurance company and they will never want to give it back to you. And so what they're doing is they're making a bet that the product will live along the beyond the 5 years or whatever it is that they're selling, and then they'll walk away with your money. And so they know what the failure rates are, and they're going to make money on it. So I don't do it.
Jim's comments seem to be right on track there, Liam.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, and any insurance company, in for any kind of insurance, you have to assume they have much better information than you do about the actual failure rates for these products. And, you know, sometimes you'll win. Like, there will, you know, like any kind of bet, there will be cases where you end up being right that your product fails sooner than they expect it to. But for the most part, it's like going to a casino. The casino is confident that they're going to end up winning. So they don't mind if a few people win, because in the long run, they're going to come out way ahead.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling. I was thinking back. There was a time I bought a new iPhone. We lived at that time on a lake, and I bought the phone. I didn't take the extended warranty. And then on the pier, like 4 days after I had bought the phone, it fell in the water. So then I went back and I bought it again. But that time I took the extended warranty. And of course, right. I never had another problem with the new phone ever.
Yeah, that's the frustrating part is, you know, you do lose sometimes, and it feels unfair. You know, I think part of it, and I've heard a number of stories similar to yours since the article published. And, you know, it's I guess every person has to do their own calculation about their actual likelihood. You know, how likely are they to be in a situation where something could go wrong? So, you know, I don't think it's fair to make the blanket statement like you should never get these, because I think there are cases where they probably do make sense. It's just really hard to figure out when those cases are. So I think the wise stance to start with is, you know, I probably don't need this, and then back into it from there. Like assess it from a place of, I should probably hang on to my money, but what are all the reasons, you know, what are all the possibilities for this to go wrong?
Liam McCabe, our guest today, writer for Wirecutter, covering home improvement. We're talking extended warranties with him. You can join in, number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Liam McCabe, writer for Wirecutter, and we're talking about extended warranties with him. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Julius in Madison. Julius, hi. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. Yeah, thanks for having me on. So I thought it was really interesting that you guys are talking about extended warranties, because I feel like there's a really common occurrence where people get these calls every time they buy a car for like the next 3 years after you buy your car. They'll be like, hey, we're calling about your car's extended warranty. And one interesting thing that I noticed when I was looking into this issue is that extended warranties, even though they're marketed as a warranty, using the same language as what your product comes with from the factory, are actually completely different from a factory warranty. They're technically what's called a service contract, which means that a manufacturer or whoever's offering the warranty can essentially skirt the regulations that a normal factory warranty would have, where companies are usually required to let you fix your own things or let you purchase your own parts and make your own repairs. And if a product still fails under the factory warranty, they'll still have to honor their promise. But yeah, under a extended service contract, which is marketed as an extended warranty, quote unquote, the terms are completely different, and they can take away your coverage if you go and seek a repair elsewhere. even though federal warranty laws like Smith-Magnuson-Moss Act in 1975, those hold factory warranties accountable and require companies to still service your product if you, even if you still are getting third-party service or fixing something yourself.
Interesting. Liam, is that how you see it?
Yeah, that's correct. So there, you know, the manufacturer's warranties are federally regulated. There's a specific law on the books that dictates the language that they're allowed to use and what they're allowed to I don't want to say skirt responsibility for, but it's along those lines. In the, you know, before that law was passed, there were a number of cases that gave warranties a bad reputation in general. There was a infamous one. I wrote about this in my story. A woman had, she was driving along in I think it was a Plymouth that was 10 days old. And all of a sudden there was a loud crack and the steering went out and she veered off to the right into a brick wall. She was hospitalized. She was okay ultimately, but they tried to get the dealer to cover the cost of all the damages to the car, like the hospital stay, the front, all the bodywork, all of that. And they said, "Well, you signed a warranty that said we will only cover the defective part. So we'll cover the steering column, but the rest of it is actually your responsibility." And a judge, in New Jersey, where the case took place, he came down on the side of the consumer instead of the car manufacturer in that case. But that was one of many examples, many cases that inspired the government to take a closer look and set some stricter rules about this.
Well, Randall in Stevens Point has something that may relate to this in a way. Randall, hi.
Well, hello. But a little story of my son having bought a pretty expensive snowblower from a big box company based in Wisconsin, and a major name brand, and it failed within 2 or 3 hours of using it. He had paid for the warranty, and we tried to collect, and finally advised him, just place a phone call every twice a week until something happens. And he told me what was happening. They had an auto hangup that would occur in 60 seconds every time you made a call. He couldn't get through for a very, very long period of time. This went on for nearly a year. And finally made a request online in writing, did all the hoops and everything. And they said, "Well, we're unable to find anyone in Wisconsin who can fix this snowblower." And they actually sent him a check for the entire price of the machine. So it was kind of interesting how that turned out.
But he had to go through a lot of hoops, even though he had the extended warranty, Liam, to get anything. And you probably have many other stories about people who have the extended warranty and ran into trouble.
Right. Yes. There's a story in the Atlantic Monthly last year about a concept called sludge. It's these tactics that companies use to try to just grind you down and get you to give up. It's like frustrating examples like that where it's impossible to get through to a human. I think for the most part, extended warranty claims go pretty well. Like there was no strong evidence that, you know, I don't think it's fair to say you're very unlikely to get, you know, made whole from it. But there are plenty of cases where that does happen. There was a gentleman I spoke to for the story who bought an extended warranty plan on a set of headphones, like a nice, expensive set of headphones. He sent them in. The service center said, "Oh, these actually work fine," and sent them back. And he's like, they don't. Like, well, you just have to plug these in and you can clearly hear that there's no audio coming out of this. So he went back and forth with them 4 times total, and they still insisted that the headphones worked. And he finally sent them a video of him plugging those headphones in next to some other ones. Like, there's no sound. And he even took them apart and showed them a video of a cable that was disconnected. And eventually they were like, okay. And they sent him a refund. which sort of like this snowblower case is a little silly, because it would have been a 3-minute fix at, you know, maybe a cost of $2 in parts. Yeah. And instead, you know, they end up sending him the $530 in return. But yes, this is a known flaw in the extended warranty ecosystem.
Bob, thanks, Randall. Bob and Madison, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me?
No, we're actually, Bob, we're having an awful time with you. We're going to have to let you go because I really can't hear you well. I'm sorry. He had a comment about cell phone warranties, but David has something relating to phone warranties too. So let's go there. David, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for all your years of service, and good luck on your retirement.
Thank you.
So anyway, yeah, I've been pretty lucky with Verizon, kind of paying the price, you know, instead of what's in the AARP magazine, stuff like that. And the last phone I bought was a Samsung, and it was pretty good for about a year and a half, and I did buy the extended warranty on it. And they sent me a different phone. I had to send my old phone in, and that was actually worse than my not-too-good-year-and-a-half-old phone. So then they told me to take it out on East Washington Avenue to this place, and I took it there. And the guy said, this isn't a new replacement phone. It's a refurbished replacement phone. And, yeah. Anyway, they sent me back another one. So the second one had the same problem with it. The third phone was finally a new phone. So anyway, the guys on East Washington Avenue out there, you break it, I fix it. That's part of Asurion. So anyway, tearing my hair. But both the replacement phones were refurbished phones, not new phones.
Common? Common, Leon, to have
yeah,
that?
That is, you know, that you have to pay attention because I think what this gets at is, you know, you can do your own research, but the amount of effort that it takes to look into the details and the diligence that you need to maintain to make sure you're getting, you know, a fair deal on these, you should take that into account along with the price of the item. So you're not only buying protection for whatever it is, $12 a month, you're also potentially, you know, signing yourself up to deal with an additional headache if you do need to take care of, you know, if you find that things are not going as smoothly as maybe the plan had advertised. So that's, you know, if you think you're buying peace of mind, that the knowledge that you're making extra work in the future should be part of the calculation, I think.
Oh, man. So is there a simple way? I mean, if I'm spending $4,000 on something, is there a way I can, and you have to probably look at the product. You have to look at is there any information about how good it lasts or how long it lasts? In other words, you have to go through a lot, but typically what happens is you're going out there, you're picking something out. You may not have done any of that, and then they're wanting to sell you the extended warranty.
Well, and even if you want to do that, it's very hard to find that information. So I worked for Consumer Reports for a little while, and they have excellent information on brand reliability. But it's by brand, not by product, not by specific model. And it's a trailing indicator also, you know, it's based on data over the past several years, weighed out by year. It can't really tell you about the new product that you're buying right now. So, you know, even if you were willing to put the work in, you can't necessarily find information that's accurate enough to help you make that like coldly calculated decision, you know?
Oh, man. Liam, this time really flew by. I'm sorry it's so fast because I've got other questions for you, but maybe you'll come back and be with us again. Look forward to it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I hear you're retiring soon.
Yeah, 59 years on the air, so it's, I guess it's time to get... My extended warranty is running out. Thanks, Liam. Liam McCabe is a writer for Wirecutter covering home improvement. And Lee Rayburn will probably talk to him next time around. Thanks to Lee Rayburn, and thanks to Joel Patnaud and Clara Neipert and Jeff Robbins, all of our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. And I am Larry Mueller, and I invite you to stay listening. Lots more in store here on WPR News.